This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 3 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has announced this morning that she intends to set the wheels in motion for a second referendum on independence. But with less than 3 years separating us from the last one, just how likely is it that Scots might take to the polls in the next few years? The bitter war of words between the Netherlands and Turkey has escalated after Turkish ministers were banned from addressing rallies of Turkish citizens in Holland ahead of a controversial referendum in Turkey, which could give Turkey's President Erdogan massive new powers. As Syrian President Bashar al-Assad signals a willingness to open up contact with the US in the fight against Daesh, will President Trump be prepared to engage with the government America previously tried to topple? François Fillon, the Republican candidate in the upcoming French elections, has said that he is the victim of a manhunt carried out by dozens of journalists who he claims are desperate to dig up dirt and discredit him. But given the serious nature of the allegations levied against Fillon, should his allegations be taken seriously? And Squirrels on Mars. No, it's not the title of the latest sci-fi blockbuster. Some people actually think there might be squirrels on Mars. All that and more over the next hour on this Monday edition of World in Focus. Next week, I will seek the authority of the Scottish Parliament to agree with the UK Government the details of a Section 30 order, the procedure that will enable the Scottish Parliament to legislate for an independence referendum. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon speaking in Edinburgh this morning, uttering the words that supporters of Scottish independence have been calling for ever since the last referendum in 2014. For more on Nicola Sturgeon's announcement, its significance and the subsequent fallout, Jack Foster has this report.
The majority of valid votes cast yesterday by the people of Scotland in response to the referendum question, should Scotland be an independent country, were in favour of no.
That was the moment on the morning of September 19th, 2014, at which 3 years of campaigning culminated in Scotland voting against its independence from the United Kingdom by 55%. It was a result which left many in Scotland utterly devastated, and given the nature of these sorts of votes, it looked like the odds of a second chance could be some years off in the future. But now, less than 3 years from that defeat, Scotland might just be about to do it all over again. At least, that's if First Minister Nicola Sturgeon gets her way. This morning, the Scottish First Minister held a press conference at Bute House in Edinburgh, at which she laid out her plans for the way ahead as the UK government stands on the edge of exiting the European Union, something which Scotland, by a margin of 12%, voted against. Here is Nicola Sturgeon speaking this morning.
Good morning, everybody. Before the end of this month, and very possibly as early as tomorrow, the Prime Minister will trigger Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, setting the United Kingdom on course to leave the EU in March 2019. It is important, therefore, for me to report now on the Scottish Government's attempts to find compromise with the UK Government and set out our plan to protect Scotland's interests. Right now, Scotland stands at a hugely important crossroads. We didn't choose to be in this position. In common with most people across the country, I wish that we weren't in this position. But we are, and the stakes are high. So we must have a plan for the way forward. Since last June, my focus has been on trying to find an agreement with the UK government, an agreement that would reconcile the UK-wide vote to leave the European Union with the Scottish vote to remain. I was encouraged in this approach by the Prime Minister's commitment last July to seek agreement with the devolved administrations on a UK-wide approach before triggering Article 50. Over the past few months, we have worked hard, really hard, to try to find agreement. The Prime Minister and her government have been given every opportunity to compromise. But today, as we stand, for all we know, on the eve of Article 50 being triggered, not only is there no UK-wide agreement on the way ahead, but the UK government has not moved even an inch in pursuit of compromise and agreement. Our efforts at compromise have instead been met with a brick wall of intransigence. I cannot pretend to the Scottish people that a compromise agreement looks remotely likely, given the hardline response from the Prime Minister so far. That means I have to decide on the best plan to protect our interests now. I will now take the steps necessary to make sure that Scotland will have a choice at the end of this process. A choice of whether to follow the UK to a hard Brexit or to become an independent country, able to secure a real partnership of equals with the rest of the UK and our own relationship with Europe. So I can confirm today that next week I will seek the authority of the Scottish Parliament to agree with the UK Government the details of a Section 30 order, the procedure that will enable the Scottish Parliament to legislate for an independence referendum.
Scotland's First Minister speaking to members of the press in Edinburgh this morning. And immediately following Nicola Sturgeon's speech, reactions began to pour in from out with her own party. Firstly, the Scottish Green Party said that they welcomed the Section 30 order request. This is, of course, crucial, as it's the six Green members of the Scottish Parliament that make up the numbers of a pro-independence majority inside the Scottish Parliament, being as all the other parties, the Conservatives, Labour and the Liberal Democrats, are staunchly opposed not just to Scottish independence, but also to a second referendum. And that's really going to be the sticking point here, and the thing that will decide whether or not this vote will actually happen. Opponents of independence will point to the fact that Scotland held a major vote on this issue less than 3 years ago, and that much was made then of 2014's referendum as a once-in-a-lifetime or once-in-a-generation opportunity. Proponents of independence, however, will be pointing to the events that have occurred in the interim, as Nicola Sturgeon did in her speech today, mainly the Brexit vote, but also the re-election of a Conservative government in London, a party, for those who don't know, are consistently unpopular in Scotland. Now, Robin McAlpine is the director of Commonweal, a pro-Scottish independence think tank and a prominent figure during the 2014 referendum. He joins me on the line now to discuss today's announcement in some more detail. Robin, are we to take from this morning that there will now definitely be a second referendum on Scotland's independence within the next 2 to 3 years?
I think what we can be certain of is now that there will be either a referendum or a constitutional crisis. So we now have a parliament that has in Scotland that has a clear majority which will ask for that referendum because the Greens will support this. Therefore, that will become the official policy of Scotland. It will then be up to Westminster to decide whether it's going to grant it or block it. If it grants it, it looks now, I think the most likely date's spring 2019. But if it doesn't, if it blocks it, then we're going to have a long and difficult constitutional period. We're going to end up in Supreme Courts. We're going to end up with civil disobedience in Scotland if they really were blocking a referendum. So I think what we're looking at is almost certainly a referendum or something very substantial about to happen if we don't get it.
Can you realistically see a scenario where it wouldn't be blocked by the UK government, though? I mean, when you look at Theresa May's government at the moment, her polling, her favourability amongst her own support base, both in Scotland and in the UK as a whole, is only going to be benefited by rejecting a second independence referendum in Scotland.
Well, yeah, that'll play brilliantly for the 18% of the Scottish population who are Tories. The rest of the Scottish population, and this is the big gamble for them, including soft no voters, are probably unlikely to see treating Scotland with contempt as being a particularly sympathetic act. So it's one of those things that if you look at polls just now, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, I'm not that hot on a new referendum right now, but just wait until they say, yeah, but you can't have one. We're not letting you have one. You're no longer going to be permitted a voice through a democratic referendum in Scotland. I think that the way that people will look at those decisions would change quite rapidly. So I think it would be very risky for the UK government if it's serious about the long-term membership of Scotland in the United Kingdom. It needs to fight and win a referendum.
Robin, you obviously quite publicly voted for independence in 2014's referendum. Now, let's imagine for a moment that that referendum had gone the other way and then it had been a win for yes. If less than 3 years later, the people who were arguing for a no vote were saying that there should be a second referendum and we should go back and have the whole question again, would you not perhaps feel a little bit cheated?
Well, it depends what circumstance are we talking about here. If we're in an event in which they had won a majority in the Parliament and that they'd built up over time a strong case for having another referendum on the basis of, for example, broken promises or a massive change in what we had been told. So, for example, if you had a situation where after the last referendum, the SNP had said, actually, no, we were lying to you, we're going to take you out of the European Union, even though we said we weren't. If big things like that had happened, then I think there'd be a pretty good case for them calling a second referendum. And that's what's happened for many of the kind of progressive, internationally minded and socially progressive no voters from the last time round. They've had Tory austerity and they've had Brexit, and that's not what they were promised.
There is a somewhat convincing argument, however, that everyone knew that those things were a possibility in 2014 and that by voting to stay within the United Kingdom, they were also voting to take on Brexit should it come along, to take on Tory governments should they come along.
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what they voted for. And one of the ways they might very well wish to take on Brexit now they know it's real is by changing their mind. So let's be clear here. Referendums are always imperfect vehicles for resolving big national questions. It's just that all the other alternatives are worse. And we are in a situation now where so much has changed. So many substantial things have changed since 2014 that going and asking the question again 5 years later does not seem to me to be anything other than normal democratic politics.
And just finally, is it winnable?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. I'll be absolutely certain from where we stand right now, looking forward, anyone who says they know the outcome of this referendum is being overly confident. It is perfectly possible for this referendum to go either way, but I'm confident that the independence movement has been holding meetings. We have been preparing for a campaign ahead. We have a good sense about how it is that we can bring wavering voters round to support the case for Scottish independence. And above all, I just think that the case for a progressive, internationalist, outward-looking United Kingdom has weakened enormously. And so we're fighting with a stronger case against a weaker case. And I do think, on balance, we'll win this one.
Robin McAlpine, thank you.
Thank you.
Robin McAlpine there, director of the pro-Scottish independence think tank Commonweal. And so as the days and weeks unravel from Nicola Sturgeon's speech today, it will become clearer just how feasible her plan is. What we can know at this stage, however, is that much of her rhetoric today was premised on the idea that the Scottish Government has been trying to find some sort of middle way ever since the Brexit vote last year, but with little in the way of success. A point the First Minister pushed during the Q&A section following her speech today.
I'm standing here as the First Minister of Scotland, and I don't know whether Article 50 is going to be triggered tomorrow or Wednesday or next week or the week after that. And that tells its own story about how far away from an equal partnership this process has been. You know, the morning of our Lancaster House speech, when I spoke to the Prime Minister on the telephone, I asked her the direct question is, are you going to rule out single market membership? And she said that wasn't a binary choice. 2 hours later, it had become a binary choice and it had been ruled out. So we have been trying to compromise. But in order to compromise, there requires to be a government on the other side willing to meet halfway, and that's not been the case. So that leads me to the position I've set out today. If Scotland is to have a genuine choice, then it must be in the way that I have set out.
Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon speaking this morning to members of the press at Bute House in Edinburgh, following on from her announcement that she intends to put the wheels in motion to facilitate a second referendum on Scottish independence. The reality of that intention will take some time to clarify, as it depends first on a vote vote in the Scottish Parliament, something which is pretty much certain to pass, and secondly on a Section 30 order. That second part will likely prove more complicated, as it requires the UK government in London to grant the powers to the Scottish Parliament to hold such a vote. But given Prime Minister Theresa May's open hostility to such a vote, that could prove complex, if not impossible. One thing is for sure, the question of Scotland's constitutional future looks set to dominate the country's politics for some years to come. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
And Jack Foster joins me in the studio now. Jack, you've been following this throughout the day. What have the reactions been to this?
Well, there have been many reactions, as I'm sure you can imagine. You could sit probably on Twitter and social media all day reading all sorts of reactions. And I imagine if you were to set your hashtag to whatever the hashtag is for this morning's announcement or IndyRef2 or something, then your Twitter feed would move very quickly. But what I've done is I've boiled it down to the more important ones. Well, perhaps what is probably the most relevant, given what we're talking about in the package there, is the response from the UK government. There hasn't actually been any sort of speech or announcement by Theresa May as yet. I'm sure she will say something in the coming days. But there was a statement put out by the UK government. They've effectively said that they're not happy with this. Pretty much written it off. They have said that the UK government will negotiate the agreement with the EU, but will do so taking into account the interests of all the nations in the UK. The Scottish government should focus on delivering good government and public services for the people in Scotland. Also, very much pointing out the fact that only a little over 2 years ago, people in Scotland voted decisively to remain part of our United Kingdom in a referendum which the Scottish government defined as a, quote, once-in-a-generation vote. So that's very much the point of view from the UK government. David Mundell, who is the Scottish Secretary and part of the Conservative government, said that people in Scotland don't share SNP tunnel vision, obsession with independence. IndyRef2 would be hugely divisive at the worst possible time. And Ruth Davidson, who's the Scottish Conservative leader, said to BBC Radio 4 this afternoon that there's no clear mandate for the Scottish government to have a referendum, and also said that the Scottish people don't want it. Jeremy Corbyn, Labour Party, a little bit of a different tack. He's opposed, but he says he won't block a second referendum, but he will oppose independence. Now, on the more sort of favourable side, Alex Salmond, as you would probably be unsurprised to learn, is quite pleased about the result.
An old meme of him dancing in Westminster has resurfaced on social media this afternoon as well.
Yeah, I mean, what I'll not do is read out Alex Salmond's comments, because you can imagine he's very keen on it. Patrick Harvey, the leader of the Green Party in Scotland, said that he welcomed the Scottish Parliament's consent being sought for a Section 30 order on an independence referendum, and as said in that package there, he said that the Green Party will support it, which obviously is quite crucial.
And you've just mentioned it there, Nicola Sturgeon. Sturgeon mentioned it, and you said in the report there. Can you just tell us what exactly does a Section 30 order mean?
Well, it sounds very complex and legal and whatnot. It's not too complicated, but I'll basically try and boil it down for you. Effectively, when the Scottish Parliament came into existence, the way in which the powers were divided between the UK Parliament and the Scottish Parliament, which is a devolved parliament of the UK Parliament, rather than setting out which powers the Scottish Parliament would have, it set out which powers the Scottish Parliament didn't have, which are known as reserved powers. And the Scottish Parliament has power over all sorts of other things that just aren't listed. Effectively, a Section 30 order is to change that, is to either permanently or temporarily bring one of those powers to the Scottish Parliament. And of course, the power to hold a referendum on the Constitution is not a power that is held at the Scottish Parliament. So they would need permission, effectively, from Westminster, from the government in London, to hold such a referendum. And that is obviously a key sticking point in all of this, because the UK government, as we know, not so keen on Scottish independence. If all that has to happen is for them not to give permission for this referendum, and there won't be a legally binding referendum.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's imagine everything goes well for the Scottish government on this. We've heard Robin McAlpine say there that he thought a referendum on independence was winnable. Is that what the polls suggest?
The polls are a funny one, as you know yourself, Carolyn, mm-hmm. when you look at them. I mean, let's remember the poll last time we had a referendum. It was 45% yes and 55% no. It was actually ever so slightly less than 45% for yes, but we round it up. And mm-hmm. And yes supporters in Scotland like to call themselves, some of them like to call themselves the 45. The Since then, the polls haven't shifted much. There have been spikes and moves, and just after the Brexit vote last year, there was a kind of a spike in support, but that seems to have levelled off, because I think a lot of people who support independence in Scotland, there were actually people who wanted out of the EU, and then there were people who voted no, who wanted to stay in the EU, and maybe they've sort of crossed over since, and it's, some of that's cancelled itself out. However, in the last week or so, there have been polls which have come out which have shown an increase, or certainly suggested an increase in favour of Scottish independence. One should remember, of course, that with these polls, there tends to be a 3% margin of error, and the difference really in the last week or so is about 3-4%.
Mm-hmm. And just as a final note, it's not coincidental, the timing of Nicola Sturgeon's speech today with regards to the UK government's Brexit bill. It goes back to the House of Commons today. Of course, the House of Lords added a series of amendments to the bill, one on ensuring that the government gets a meaningful vote on the outcome of negotiations, one to protect the rights of EU citizens in the UK. Now, the most likely scenario that people are expecting to happen is the House of Commons today will throw those amendments out. There's a majority in the House of Commons held by the Conservatives, so that is possible, and the bill will get sent for royal assent. If that happens, Article 50, triggering the negotiations to leave the EU, could be triggered tomorrow. And one of the things that you mentioned at the end of the report there was that Nicola Sturgeon said that she doesn't know when Article 50 will be triggered. It could be tomorrow, it could be next week. And this suggests that she's not getting clear updates from the UK government, and that Theresa May isn't going out of her way to keep Nicola Sturgeon in the loop.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm sure Nicola Sturgeon's not the only person that doesn't feel in the loop. There are, of course, people who've come out of the civil service and so on in the last few months who have said similar things. And, of course, when Article 50 might be triggered is the tip of the iceberg, because the whole problem is that no one even really knows what's going to happen once it gets triggered. No one knows what the negotiation's going to be. So there are lots and lots of question marks over Brexit.
And if it does happen tomorrow morning, we will be back here discussing that tomorrow, I'm sure.
Sure we will, Carolyn.
Jack Foster, thank you.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, the bitter war of words between the Netherlands and Turkey has escalated after Turkish ministers were banned from addressing rallies of Turkish citizens in Holland ahead of a controversial referendum in Turkey, which could give Turkey's President Erdogan massive new powers. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk programme has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will kill myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, and muckraker from bradblog.com. Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
I'm Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Tune in!
Well, maybe mention like central bankers and you know, markets are doubling down. Not, you're saying everybody's doubling down, they're crazy.
They are! Everyone's crazy!
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Radio Sputnik.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, the bitter war of words between the Netherlands and Turkey has escalated after Turkish ministers were banned from addressing rallies of Turkish citizens in Holland ahead of a controversial referendum which could give President Erdogan massive new powers. As Syrian President Bashar al-Assad signals a willingness to open up contact with the US in the fight against Daesh, will President Trump be prepared to engage with the government America previously tried to topple? And is there a squirrel on Mars? Well, of course there isn't, but some people think otherwise. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Relations between Turkey and the Netherlands have taken a swift turn for the worse ahead of a referendum in Turkey on April 16th, which could give enormous powers to Turkey's President Erdogan, increasing his presidential responsibilities and grip on the country. There are significant Turkish populations in both Germany and the Netherlands which are eligible to vote in the referendum, which has been leading to diplomatic tensions between all three countries as Erdogan's ministers attempt to address rallies in the Netherlands and Germany to gain support for April's vote. Rallies of Turkish residents in Holland have been cancelled or members of Erdogan's government have been prevented from addressing them. And of course, significantly, the Netherlands is holding a general election this week in just 2 days' time, with the right-wing anti-Islam Party for Freedom led by Geert Wilders riding high in the polls. Speaking yesterday, Erdogan said, quote, "I call on all international organisations in Europe and elsewhere to impose sanctions on the Netherlands. Has Europe said anything? No. Why? Because they don't bite each other. The Netherlands are acting like a banana republic," end quote. For more on this, I'm joined on the line by Sputnik's Jim Ensom. Jim, just get us up to speed on why this row is kicked off now.
Relations between the two countries have taken a turn for the worst ahead of the referendum on April the 16th, which is due to give Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan extra powers. The amendments to the constitution include the introduction of an executive presidency that replaces the existing parliamentary system of government and the abolition of the office of prime minister. Now, there is a significant population of Turkish citizens in the Netherlands. There has been for many, many years, guest workers they're known as, particularly in Rotterdam, Amsterdam and The Hague. And what the Turkish government has been trying to do is to send over ministers, including they hoped the foreign minister, to try and rally support for the referendum, because there are significant pockets of populations who are eligible to vote in that referendum. It's very, very controversial. And it's in particular, what's really behind this is the fact that there's the referendum in Turkey and they're trying to whip up support for it in the Netherlands. But also at the same time, don't forget that this coming Wednesday, the 15th of March, there is a general election in the Netherlands, and the anti-Islam party, Geert Wilders' party, Party of Freedom, they are really, really heavily campaigning, and they're using, they're riding this crest of a wave of this diplomatic row going on between the two countries. So it's a tinderbox of two clashing cultures going on at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And why specifically is this kicking off in the Netherlands?
Well, for many, many years following the Second World War, the Netherlands wanted guest workers. And a lot of people from Turkey work in the Rotterdam area, Amsterdam, The Hague. They work in all sorts of things, including the hospitality, the catering industry, and others. So there is a lot of there have been a lot of rallies due to be taking place in the Netherlands. And the Turks, very interestingly enough, they were going to send the foreign minister over to one of these rallies, but Mark Rutte, the prime minister of the Netherlands, made it quite clear last week that he didn't want the foreign minister going over there. I was looking on my little app that I have on my iPad, which is a plane spotting app, which is the sort of thing I do because I'm sad. But I noticed there that they showed a picture of a foreign ministry aircraft from Turkey that landed in Rotterdam airport, apparently without permission. This was after the foreign minister was told he would be not welcome, and the deportation of another minister. So there's been all sorts of tensions winding up, and it's particularly important ahead of that referendum in April, and of course the Dutch election in on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. And of course we've also seen a similar standoff in Berlin over the last couple of weeks. I don't know if your plane spotting app has given you any info on that standoff.
Sadly, not on that particular one, but no. I mean, again, there's a significant population of Turks living in Germany. 1.4 million are eligible to vote. And there have been huge tensions because the Germans' authorities have been stopping rallies, ostensibly on the grounds of security reasons. And Erdogan accused Berlin of Nazi tactics, which is very, very serious diplomatic speak. And that led to German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying this must stop. And of course, the standoff between Germany and Turkey is all the more important because it was Angela Merkel who largely broke the EU-Turkey migrant deal to send Turkish refugees or irregular migrants back from Greece to Turkey. The NGOs, including the UNHCR, the refugee agency, were all against it because they say that Turkey is not a safe third country under the Geneva Convention. So that's been a problem, a diplomatic hassle between the two, which has been compounded by the fact that they've been whipping up support for Erdogan in rallies that have been arranged in various cities all across Germany. So tensions, diplomatic row is winding up. Don't forget, too, that both the Netherlands and Germany and Turkey are all NATO members. So it's starting a spat within NATO as well.
Mm-hmm. And it does seem like the migrant deal has kind of tied the hands of many European nations with regards to Turkey at the moment.
Very much so, because, of course, it was contingent on the acceleration of Turkish accession into the European Union. And, of course, because of the failed coup last year, Turkey has increased his grip on power. And this referendum is seen as a sort of a power grab by the president to make his executive powers even more closer to himself and extending his grip on power. And the EU-Turkey migrant deal is almost dead in the water, in all honesty, because the Turkish accession is going nowhere at the moment because of the standoff between Ankara and its European neighbours.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim Ensom, thank you very much.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
You are listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It is 33 minutes past the hour. For years, US foreign policy has tried to create regime change in Syria and force Syrian President Bashar al-Assad from office. Instead, the country has endured one of the most brutal and bloody conflicts of recent times, with thousands left dead and millions of refugees created. But now both Syria and Russia have signalled a wish to re-establish new contact with the US administration under President Trump. Our reporter Mark Hurst has been exploring whether the United States will respond positively to the proposal.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has described US President Donald Trump's policies on Syria as promising and signaled he is willing to cooperate with Washington in the fight against Daesh. The Syrian leader made the comments just hours before Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Gennady Gatilov indicated the Russian government was also willing to resume direct contact with the US on the future political settlement for Syria. The latest development comes as the US prepares to host a major international conference in Washington that will bring together 6 to 8 countries to discuss ways to accelerate the ongoing military offensive against Daesh in Iraq and Syria. In Mosul, once a major stronghold for Daesh, the remaining fighters of the Islamic extremist group are now cut off and trapped as anti-Daesh forces continue to advance through the city. So with a broad international consensus directed against Daesh, is now the time for a major rethink about how the global community should work together? And will President Trump be willing to engage positively with Syria and Russia to guarantee the defeat of the Islamic terror group? Joining me now is David Alfer, adjunct professor at the School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution at the George Mason University in Virginia. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said he is willing to work with Donald Trump in Syria. The US previously wanted regime change in Syria and supported the toppling of Assad, but with the conclusion of the conflict more or less assured for Assad, do you think Trump would be wise to work with this former American adversary?
He can't be shut out of the process entirely, but the important thing is to work with him in context, only in context of other agents within the Syrian context that can balance him out. Right now, if we work with Assad directly or only, what it sends a message is that you can do whatever you want as long as you get away with it in the end. What we need to do is work with, and by agent, what I mean is other forms of Syrian civil society, other entities within the Syrian civil society that gives some message that we do not simply intend to work with someone who has been accused of committing war crimes and using chemical weapons against his own people. It has to be in context, if at all. It cannot simply be with Assad.
Turning to Trump's policy advisers, was it not inevitable, given the radical different agenda Trump set out during his campaign, that he was never going to turn to established advisers when he took office? He was always inevitably going to favour those with unconventional views. But is that necessarily a dangerous approach?
Yes, it is. Because unconventional views is a very diplomatic way of saying they have no experience. Not only did they not have any experience in this, but several of them, such as Steve Bannon and Miller, appear to actually be intending to pull down every system they come across. If you are going to be in a position like the President of the United States, you need advisors who actually understand the systems that are operating to make things work. You need advisors who actually understand the international system, who understand the dynamics of conflict in a place like Syria, who understand how the American military and diplomatic corps and development agency all work together and towards what purpose. So I dislike a word like unconventional because it implies that they actually are experienced and knowledgeable, but just coming at things from a different direction. And what we have are advisors who are simply not knowledgeable. They are not experienced. They have no basis to approach this with. Their only recognizable agenda thus far, in as much as they have one at all, is destruction of the very systems they are set at the top of. So it is a grave and terrible mistake, hopefully not a catastrophic one, to have gone into this presidency with advisors like this. They deserve the name not at all.
The former CIA officer Robert Baer previously told us that Russia saved the US from what he described was a potential catastrophe in Syria by effectively vetoing a UN-backed resolution that would have given President Obama the legitimacy to launch a major ground invasion of Syria to assist in the overthrow of Assad. Trump has this big international conference coming up later this month in Washington. Do you think that might lead to a major change in policy towards Syria?
Well, first, Robert Baer is incorrect about that. There wouldn't have been a major ground invasion under Obama. We are now seeing what looks like a gradual expansion of ground action in Syria against Daesh. Yes, Russia did not save us from this. This was Obama policy, and Obama was never going to increase troops to that degree. The current climate is such that we are already seeing increases. There are now more Rangers and Marines on the ground. We are seeing an increase in the military presence, but we're not seeing an increase, and this is where the mistake is. We're not seeing an increase in any significant planning for diplomatic, for development, for civil society, rebuilding and construction, following any military action. And this is the critical point, which has been missed by every planner in the administration, the last administration and this one. Even were we to land the 101st and Marines and everybody else on top of Daesh, militarily wipe them off the face of the planet, which first of all can't be done. We are still left with a ruin of a civil society, which is not trustful of its own government, which does not have what it needs to survive, which is mistrustful of its own population, because now you have this mixture of collaborators and resistors and victims and perpetrators all mixed into the same bunch of people who still live there. And unless that actually moves forward, unless resilience is built into that system, unless that's improved, there will be no safety in Syria, there will be no security in Syria, and the entire place will be nothing but a breeding ground, more ISIS 2.0. There's where the work needs to go. We are seeing an increase in military usage. It will not rise to the level of an Iraq-style invasion, but it is going up. It's not going to succeed.
Do you think U.S. policy in regard to Syria was contradictory under President Obama, given that the U.S. was supporting the Kurds in northern Syria at the same time that America's ally, Turkey, which is also a member of NATO, was attacking them and, in fact, is still determined to defeat them?
It's one of many problems for the U.S. in that region. It's not that U.S. policy was contradictory under Obama so much as that entire region contains nothing but wicked problems. In order to drive Daesh out, you will need support from the Kurds. You will also need support from the Turks, who are not very fond of the Kurds and consider at least one of their groups to be a terrorist organization. That's not contradictory policy on our part or anybody's part. That is simply, this is a very complex region. It needs complex understanding. This is where the real worry, among the real worries, is with the Trump administration, is that as I would say Obama's policy was more incoherent than contradictory. We don't have a strong centralized policy for that region. Trump has nothing. There is no policy there. There is nothing but contradiction. So what Trump is going to need to understand is this is a very complicated place. It needs very complicated understanding. It needs significant diplomatic work in order to get those various different parties, many of whom are at each other's throats, to work together in order to solve this mutual problem. And it can't be done without working with the Kurds. It can't be done without working with the Turks. Various other actors throughout that area are also critical, the Iraqis, who are in turn in different parties within their own country, many of whom are antagonistic. That requires diplomacy, that requires development. That is not a military problem. And it's not that policy is contradictory. The area is simply complex, and it requires very well-informed, very experienced people to deal with it.
What's your assessment of the UN's involvement in Syria? Has the conflict demonstrated that the UN is in need of major reform to make it fit for purpose?
The UN has been fulfilling an absolutely vital humanitarian role in Syria. They have been one of the major actors helping to alleviate the humanitarian crisis which is coming along with this conflict. Is the UN in need of reform? Sure. I can't think of a major international organization or any sort of an entity like this that isn't in need of some form of reform. But does the Syrian conflict demonstrate that past any hope of fixing it? No. What we need is for Russia to stop blocking the actions that would help to end the conflict. What we need is for the U.S. and for the other actors involved to get together and work on diplomacy, work on development, work on planning for how does a civil society rebuild, and not to stop with dot, 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 and then ISIS disappeared. Right now, the extent of anybody's planning is a hypothetical military action that takes out Daesh, and then everything is fine, and that's simply not going to happen.
The Russian government has said in the past couple of hours that it's willing to resume direct contact with the US in order to coordinate efforts in Syria. What's your assessment on that, and how do you think the US government should respond?
I think if it's an honest outreach, then it should always be considered and met with a friendly response. I think there is always room for that. But it should be taken cautiously, because our history tells us that this is not always what it looks like. But it should be considered, and it should be approached with all diplomatic formality and taken to see what's really there. Absolutely.
And finally, what do you think will be the areas of foreign policy that will prove the biggest challenge to President Trump, given that he has signaled a more general rolling back of U.S. interventionism on the global stage?
Right now, it doesn't appear that he's signaling a rollback with interventionism. He's signaling a rollback of diplomacy and development, but the military arms of intervention are actually increasing. We see this in Yemen. We see it in Syria. So I would be very cautious with his statement that he is going to roll back interventionism. It will be a problem in Israel, Palestine, and Iraq, as well as in Syria. It will be a problem in the South China Sea and with China in general. And those are the ones that I would highlight the most.
David Alford, many thanks for joining us on World in Focus.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, François Fillon, the Republican candidate in the upcoming French elections, has said that he is the victim of a manhunt carried out by dozens of journalists who he claims are desperate to dig up dirt and discredit him. But given the serious nature of the charges levied against Fillon, should his assertions be taken seriously? That's in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Hard Facts is a show that gets to the heart of the matter. We question the mainstream media narrative to get to the truth about world affairs.
I don't think they have a clue what they're doing in Syria.
Basically, it's the sixth attempt by the big powers to overthrow a Middle East government.
Whether it is regime change, masked as revolution, imperialism masked as democracy and human rights, on Hard Facts, we peel back the layers to get to the real story other media doesn't want you to hear.
Absolutely astonishing the British government reacted to this case simply by lying.
Hard Facts.
Tom Hartmann. This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, François Fillon, the Republican candidate in the upcoming French elections, has said that he is the victim of a manhunt carried out by dozens of journalists who he claims are desperate to dig up dirt and discredit him. But given the serious nature of the numerous charges levied against Fillon, should his assertions be taken seriously? And Squirrels on Mars. No, it's not the title of the latest sci-fi blockbuster or flop for that matter. Some people really think there's a squirrel on Mars. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. I'm Carolyn Scott, and it's 47 minutes past the hour. The Republican candidate for the upcoming French elections, François Fillon, has hit out at the French media and some major institutions, stating that he is the victim of a manhunt. In an interview with the French national radio station Europe 1, Fillon said that dozens of journalists were rummaging through his bins to find dirt on him. Fillon is, of course, at the centre of a major scandal dubbed by many as the fake job scandal. He'll be facing prosecutors in just 2 days' time as part of an official inquiry into allegations that he paid his wife and children out of parliamentary funds for jobs they did not do. He has also now come under fire for receiving over €40,000 worth of designer clothes from an anonymous donor and from potentially taking loans from other backers. The fake jobs scandal alone has seen Fillon fall in the polls. He entered the race as a favourite, but is now expected to struggle to make it through to the first round of voting. Joining me on the line to discuss this is Professor James Shields, Professor of French Politics at the University of Aston. Professor Shields, are we being too hard on Fillon? He says he's the victim of a manhunt carried out by dozens of journalists desperate to get dirt on him. What do you make of those statements?
Well, Fillon's campaign has been off the rails for the past 6 weeks or so, since the allegations over fake jobs for his wife and two of his children first emerged. He's made several attempts to relaunch, but his woes just keep piling up. And from being the runaway favourite for the presidency, he's now relegated to third place and may very well not qualify for the decisive second round. His claims to be the victim of a political assassination, a manhunt, a democratic hold-up, etc., don't sit well with a potential president of the Republic. I think that's the main thing we have to say. We get into dangerous waters when a presidential candidate denounces key institutions the justice system and the media as being biased or in some way corrupted. And of course, he's been aiming his barrels at both of these major institutions, the media and the judiciary. This undermines public trust in institutions at a time when it's already at a low point, and when it should be Fillon's role as a potential president to be the guarantor of those institutions. He's a man who feels beleaguered, of course, and it's certainly true that the media are focusing a strong lens on him, but this is in the nature of things. Fillon himself famously said early in his campaign that if you stand for high office, you should be irreproachable. So we might say that the media are just taking him at his word, and there's an easy maxim that can be applied not just to Fillon, but to all figures in public life. Don't do anything you wouldn't like the media to discover and report.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the fake job scandal, as many people are calling it, is a big deal. You know, if he's found guilty of that, that's quite a large charge. Right now, there's another scandal emerging about him having received perhaps around €48,000 worth of clothing from, one from an anonymous donor. On the surface, this seems like an easier one to push aside and say, oh, come on now, people are complaining about the clothes I wear. But this in itself is also receiving donations without any transparency, isn't it?
Yes. And the problem for Fillon is that a number of these allegations against him might not look so serious if they weren't part of a growing list. The most serious case against him, as you rightly say, remains the investigation into alleged fake jobs. But there's also this revelation of an undeclared interest-free loan from a billionaire friend whom Fillon, while Prime Minister, put forward for France's highest honour, the Grand Cross of the Legion of Honour. Now, this raises the question of influence peddling, which, if it were found to be true, would be a very serious charge. Then there's the other revelation, the one you mentioned, of the free clothes from a chic Parisian tailor, courtesy of a mystery benefactor. Over the weekend, we might add, Fillon had to apologise for an anti-Semitic tweet about presidential rival Emmanuel Macron put out by his campaign team. And this Wednesday, he's expected to be placed under formal investigation for misappropriation of public funds in the fake jobs inquiry. So the problem is the fact that there's a list of things and a kind of drip, drip, drip effect.
Mm-hmm. It does seem like his desire to become president is overshadowing everything else right now, because surely for the sake of his own legacy, if he were to say right now, well, I am innocent and I will see this investigation through, I'm going to step down and let somebody else run, would that not be more beneficial to his legacy?
Well, it might be more beneficial to his party. The party has gone through an existential crisis in the last few weeks. Too divided, really, to be able to remove Fillon by one means or another and replace him with anyone else, because they can't agree, for one thing, on who they would replace him with. So it would have served his party, arguably, had Fillon stood down at the very start of this some 6 weeks or so ago. The way he sees it would be the opposite of the scenario you suggest. The way Fillon seems to see it is that the only means of protecting his legacy now is to see through his candidacy, be exonerated in due course, win the presidency and implement his platform. Anything else according to what he says, anything else is unthinkable at this stage for him. And because he has, because he won the primary election, and therefore he has the legitimacy of having come through that process, unless he willingly steps aside, which he clearly has no intention of doing, nobody can really remove him. It's an extremely difficult situation for his party, and they've gone through torment in recent weeks over this.
Is there not also perhaps an element that if another candidate is going to come forward from the Republican Party, that it might be in their best interest to do so at the last minute, so there's not time to find any dirt on that candidate?
Well, that's an argument. The big problem in throwing another candidate into the ring is that you definitely consign the Republicans to not making the second round. As it stands, Fillon is in third place, and he may very well not qualify. But the best hope that the Republicans have of getting their candidate into the runoff is to stick with one and one only. If they put a second in that would divide the centre-right vote in the first round, you could be sure that Le Pen and Macron, as things stand, would sail through to the decisive second round. So I don't think it's even an option for the Republicans to put another candidate in and run what might be described as a kind of second primary election to decide which of them would prevail. In the end, it would be academic, because in splitting their own vote, neither of them would have a chance of making the second round.
Mm. And just finally, is it a sign of how far the socialists have fallen that we're no longer even really talking about Benoît Hamon in all of this? They don't seem to be able to monopolise on these scandals that Fillon's facing.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. The socialists are not even in the picture. Mm-hmm. Because if we pan back a bit from Fillon, who are we talking about? Macron, the independent centrist, or Le Pen, the far-right candidate? We're not talking about Benoît Hamon. He is struggling right now to get himself noticed, to get his platform out there. He's just not managing it. And there's a classic case of a divided vote, because Hamon and Jean-Luc Mélenchon, out wide on the far left, those two are competing over very similar left-wing electorates, and neither of them is making any kind of traction.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Shields, thank you so much for joining us again on World in Focus.
My pleasure.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
And finally, squirrels on Mars? Probably not. But some people are sure that a picture of the surface of Mars shows a little squirrel running through the red rocks. By some people, I refer to a small group of UFO spotters who have pounced on the picture published by NASA. They believe it's part of a secret experiment that NASA are carrying out to see how long a squirrel could survive on Mars. I've looked at the picture, it looks a bit like a rock that looks a bit like a squirrel, but it's not actually that crazy to look at photos and think you can see a squirrel. And to explain why, Jack Foster is here to give us the lowdown on a thing called apophenia.
Well, I mean, I'm not promising the lowdown, but yeah, I've not actually seen this photograph. I feel a bit left out of this story. Apophenia, yes. Or is it pareidolia? There are sort of two subsects of this phenomenon. Basically, it's where the mind sees a familiar pattern of something where none exists, such as animals, faces, objects in clouds, that kind of thing. The man in the moon is the most famous mm-hmm. example. And one more example I will give you, which you will like this one, Carolyn, is from an episode of The Simpsons. Now, if you remember, there was an episode where there was a big cliff called Geezer Rock, which had a face in it, and it actually fell apart because Homer Simpson climbed up it and pulled a branch out of it. Crushed Mr. Burns as well.
So it's not that crazy to see a squirrel on the surface of Mars?
Well, no. There's another face on Mars that people saw, but as soon as they got a better camera, they realised it was just a rock.
Well, that is unfortunately all we have time for in this edition of World in Focus. You can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. As listeners outside of the United States may have noticed, World in Focus started 1 hour early today due to the American clocks changing. We'll be an hour early for listeners across Europe at 3 p.m. UK time until the clocks go back in 2 weeks. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh, and just want me to hand over to Washington, D.C. And until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott.
Me, Jeff Foster. Goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.